Phoenix.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As of today, we are halfway through 2014, and already Charlotte-Mecklenburg Animal Care and Control has taken in more than 12,000 dogs and cats. On Saturday, there was an article in the Charlotte Observer about the latest rescue of mistreated animals. It read, 56 dogs hidden under dirty, matted fur and exhausted from poor living conditions arrived at the Humane Society of Charlotte on Thursday night. The dogs had likely never been inside a house, received food, water, blankets, or love from their owners. This is an ongoing problem, hampered by a lack of resources, as well as a puppy mill or breeder industry unencumbered by any regulations or standards. So this hour, we take a look at the challenge of rehoming a pet that has been taken in by animal control and about ways to reduce the problem of animal mistreatment and neglect. And we're joined by Shelley Moore, President and CEO of the Humane Society of Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Nia Warren is Community Outreach Director of the Charlotte Chapter of the Coalition to Unchain Dogs. She's also an attorney at James McElroy and Deal, so watch out if you chain your dog. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Mark Balestra is also with us. He is Director of Animal Care and Control at the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Mike.
We have representatives, obviously, of three different organizations in Charlotte-Mecklenburg that deal with pets and pet welfare and the treatment of pets and their rescue from abuse and neglect. How many other agencies deal with this in town? Do we know?
Well, we're the main organizations that have physical sheltering facilities, but there's, Mark, hundreds of animal rescue groups that are doing work here in our community, good work trying to help save animals and get them placed into new homes.
And why such a great need? It seems to me that people who have dogs and cats want them because they're pets, they're considered pets, they must have some attraction, some affinity for these animals. Why do they have them if they're going to mistreat them and ignore them? And they need to be rescued.
Agreed. We're still dealing with the overpopulation of companion pets in this community. So in your introductions earlier, everything's not gloom and doom. We just want to say that even with the intake numbers of 12,000 this year, we're significantly down from what it used to be years ago, 20 years ago. Our population, our people population, has grown to close to 1 million people, and we're probably looking at around 13,000 intake this year. When our population was 300,000, we were taking in 22,000 animals. So through the collaboration of our groups right here and our community partners, everyone is taking their part and doing their part.
To what do you attribute the decline?
A lot of different things. There's no one particular item, but spaying and neutering is certainly one of the largest things to decrease the breeding, finding a partnership that can assist us with taking and transitioning animals out of the facility into their partner in care, using their network to find adopters as well.
Now, if I understood you correctly, you just said this year you will probably take in 13,000 dogs. And here it is, June the 16th, and you've already taken in 12,168 dogs as of last Thursday. That was the number I was given last Thursday. So that means you have less than 1,000 to go, but we've taken in almost 12,000 in the first 6 months of the year. Why are you so optimistic?
Because we run a fiscal year.
There you go.
There's the first reason. So our year is coming to a close here, June 30th, and that's how we've been measuring, was on a fiscal year.
So how does that figure stand up against other cities of this size? 13,000.
I think really the Charlotte community is doing an excellent job. The private-public sector partnership that both Shelley and our organizations have is working out extremely well. It's very unique, and it just offers so many different advantages than working independently. We work constantly together. We just recently received a national partnership with the ASPCA. They're providing us a variety of resources, including financial resources, to assist the community in finding better ways to retain pets in the home. And I think that's what some of the challenge is, and that's what our goal is.
Let me ask, but let's talk about each of your individual agencies here, because we have three different agencies, and I'm sure that almost everyone has heard of the Humane Society in the United States, and by extension, the Humane Society of Charlotte. How do most people in the community use your organization, and what services do you provide that maybe they don't know about?
Well, first, I think it's important to clarify that each Humane Society and in every community is an independent organization. So unlike some nonprofits like Boy Scouts or Red Cross that have an umbrella organization, Humane Societies don't. So our local organization is governed by an independent set of bylaws and independent volunteers and board of directors, and all of our funding comes from local people here. We don't get money trickled down from an umbrella organization, nor are we eligible for a lot of corporate money or grant money.
Why not?
Because in the nonprofit world, in our sector, in this community, most of the focus is in the arts, health and human services, and animals don't fall within the giving guidelines, a lot of corporate philanthropy programs. Okay. So we really have to depend on the people here in our community that care about our mission and love animals to make a difference here in our community. And we have very generous support, and we're fortunate for that.
And what do you do? For people who don't know exactly what you do, what do you do?
Okay, well, we do a lot, but our overall mission is to really improve the lives of companion animals here in our community and make sure that these animals that are here have a positive outcome. We are a managed admission shelter, which means that we only bring in animals that we feel we can rehome. So we're not going to intake animals that are aggressive or a liability to the community or that have health issues that cannot be managed.
And where do you get them? Where do they come from?
That's a really good question. So we really focus on our community here, and we take in owner surrenders from people that are living in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area that can no longer keep their pets.
So these are people who care enough to take them somewhere where these animals are most likely to be rehomed.
Right, right. And the unfortunate part is that we can't take all of those.
And do you take in animals that are found by the side of the road that maybe somebody sees when they're driving past, they pick them up, they bring them to you? Do you take them too?
That is one piece that we don't do.
Okay.
So we feel, and Mark agrees, that it's really important that when people are looking for a missing pet that they know one place to go. So all the stray animals are taken into the city shelter.
Okay.
The Animal Care and Control Agency. So the other place that we source animals from is from Animal Care and Control here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. And over the past 4 years, our organization has kind of transitioned our philosophy on really how we do intake and really becoming part of this community solution. So we definitely made a conscious effort to say we're going to transfer as many animals in from Animal Care and Control to help that burden of those 12 to 13,000 animals that are ending up at Mark's door and trying to help him have positive outcomes for those animals.
We'll talk to Mark about what they do over there in a second, but I want to talk to Nia for a moment about the Charlotte chapter of the Coalition to Unchain Dogs, of which you are, what, the founder or the co-founder or the founder?
The founder, yes, of the Charlotte chapter.
This is fundamentally, if I'm not mistaken, a North Carolina organization.
That's correct. In Durham by Amanda Arrington, yes, in 2007.
So how did you come to start it here?
Well, it was actually just because I had seen chain dogs in our community, a number of them, a lot of them, and there was really no way to help them. There were no resources. I could do what I could do myself, but it needed to be bigger than that. So I met this family who had a dog that was chained outside. I was fascinated by this family. I learned so much. I learned about dogs that live in poverty along with their owners and their family, and figured out that we needed to do something to help them.
Let's back up, because a lot of people who are listening, because you take a non-judgmental approach.
That's correct.
Toward this problem.
Yes.
So there may be a lot of people out there who have never considered that chaining up a dog to a tree or a post in the front or the backyard all day is wrong. Why is it wrong? And what's your approach to telling them that you shouldn't do this?
Well, there are a number of reasons why I believe it's wrong. The first is it's a safety issue. Dogs that are chained outside are more likely to bite than dogs that are not chained. And, I look at it like a swimming pool. If you have a swimming pool outside that a child can just walk into, that's dangerous. And in Charlotte, we have an ordinance that says you've got to put a fence around those. I want the same thing for dogs. I think there needs to be a fence around those. So the first thing is a safety issue for the community and primarily children in the community. But secondly, it's not good for the dog. There's no right way to chain a dog. They end up tangled. They end up with injuries. They can't reach their shelter. They can't reach their water in the hot sun.
So if I understood your initial story, what really got you on this road mm-hmm. toward this organization was that you drove past this dog chained up in a yard every day.
That's right.
For a long time. And
that's
you
right.
finally decided to do something that most people, I would wager, would not do. You went up and knocked on the door.
I did.
And told them how much you liked their dog.
I did. I told them they had the most beautiful pit bull I had ever seen. And they were shocked.
I'll bet.
They were, and not in a bad way, but because most people who had knocked on their door or left them a note said really rude things to them about their dog or reported them to animal care and control and had an officer come out there to check on the dog. And I approached it in a different way, and it made all the difference.
You were successful. Why? What would, if you get a visit from a police officer because of a complaint about a chained-up dog, and other people have complained, and you don't do anything to change. You walk up to the door and say, hey, I like your dog.
That's right.
And they change. What's up with that?
It's fundamental diplomacy. You know, it really is. It's just a fundamental way that you treat other people when you want to talk to them about what is going on. And I didn't assume that I understood that situation.
So what was the situation?
So the situation was that they had this dog when they lived elsewhere. They moved to this house, and their landlord said, you can't have a dog inside. So they didn't have the funds for a fence, so they chained their dog outside. They had a son who had Down syndrome and loved this dog very much. So giving up the dog was not an option, nor should it have been. That child loved that dog. And so then, you know, as I got to know them, I realized that a lot of times because of medical expenses, they didn't have enough money to feed their dog. They didn't have transportation as well. So they would get on a bus and they'd go to, you know, all the food pantries trying to find dog food for their dog. I went in there once in the winter and they had the oven door open because they had no heat. And that is how they were staying warm. And all of this kind of came together. It was like the perfect storm for me. And suddenly I realized, you know, there are people living in poverty. Of course there are going to be dogs living in poverty. Of course there are. So instead of saying, give up your dog, let's add to the number that are going into the shelter, instead I said, how can I help you keep your dog? How can I help you make sure that your dog gets what your dog needs? And, you know, when we look at statistics, I think the animal control statistics that you have, that's one way to look at what's going on in our community. But the other is to know that in the United States, there are 23 million dogs living in poverty. 3 to 4 million are going into shelters in the United States, but 23 million are living in poverty. And I just want to address that.
Yeah.
So I want to help people by helping their dogs.
We'll find out exactly what you do a little later on in the program
for
some of these people. But I'm curious as to how the three of you think about that problem. If there are 23 million dogs living in poverty, they're living in poverty because their owners
Correct.
Are in poverty. Should you be a pet owner if you're living in poverty? Because being a pet owner is darned expensive.
Well, I can answer that because I think there's been a huge...
30 seconds.
Okay, I'll try. I think there's been a huge philosophical change. I know within our organization and trending across animal welfare throughout the country. And, you know, for a long time, I think a lot of us did have that belief that, you know, if you cannot afford to have a dog or a cat, that you just shouldn't have one.
Let me stop you there, and I'll get the other side of that philosophy in a moment. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the professional MBA program at USC's Darla Moore School of Business, convenient location in Uptown Charlotte. Details at moore.sc.edu/PMBA. Well, we have talked many times on this program about summer movies. Now, let's zero in on summer reading. Summer vacations are a time when a lot of people catch up on their reading, so we're going to take a look at some of the gems that might be awaiting you and hear about several significant changes in the book publishing industry affecting both writers and readers. It seems that while big box bookstores continue to suffer in the wake of online sellers, there seems to be a shift back to independent bookstores. We find out why tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, millions of Americans do not have dental insurance. Visits to the ER for oral health problems have skyrocketed. Why many public health experts say the U.S. is facing a dental care crisis and what can be done about it.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about pets today and pet welfare in Charlotte with Mark Balestra, Director of Animal Care and Control for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Leah Warren is Community Outreach Director and founder of the Charlotte Chapter of the Coalition to Unchain Dogs. And Shelley Moore is President and CEO of the Humane Society of Charlotte. And I asked her the question just before the break. If 23 million dogs are living in poverty because their owners are in poverty, is it a good idea to have a pet if you cannot support them properly? And you said that was the original philosophy, that maybe you should not. But now, obviously, things have shifted.
Yeah, I think everybody believed that for a long time. But the reality is just because we believe that doesn't mean it's not happening, and that people living in poverty do have pets. And a lot of time, these pets are a lot of what they all they have if
right.
they go through a hard time. So we, within our organization, also in the whole community, have shifted into saying, how can we support them? How can we be a resource? So those particular animals living in poverty with those people don't end up in shelters, because we know the outcome may not be positive if they do. So we and the Humane Society of Charlotte, we have a lot of programs that are geared toward providing assistance to people that cannot afford to provide spay-neuter or basic wellness. We also have a program called Pets for Life, where we have somebody boots on the ground in those communities, similar to the work that Nia does, going door to door and trying to bring those services to those communities. Because a lot of times they're deserts. They don't have a lot of veterinary services that are available or affordable, or even pet stores to buy things for their pets.
We haven't had a chance to talk to Mark Balestra, who is the Director of Animal Care and Control for the CMPD. He's the guy that you would have said in the 1940s ran the dog pound. But that's not the case anymore, I'm told. When the county's first animal control agency opened in 1944, it did operate under that old dog catcher model, where we used to see it in the Our Gang comedy film. So the truck would pull up and the guy would step out with a net, capture the dog, throw him in the back, and take him to the pound. Now, you've been with Animal Care and Control for 24 years. Things have changed substantially in that time, I'm told.
Substantially, and I'm fortunate to play a role in that transition that it made. Yeah, we've gotten away from the catch-and-kill mentality in that particular model. It just doesn't work. And then kind of going back to what Shelley was saying, people are always going to own pets, regardless of their socioeconomical status. They're just going to own pets. And we've some of the most gentle pet owners, more responsible pet owners, that were actually homeless. Mm. So I think is what Shelley mentioned, finding resources to be able to retain pets in those homes. And we've embraced the community to help us doing just that. And as Shelley mentioned, food pantries, when the economy was really down, we saw a slight spike in people surrendering their pets because they just flat out didn't have food and those resources for medical care, veterinary care.
Right.
Basic essentials and food. So the community supported, got behind that, started making donations. We've been a very big supporter of providing free rabies inoculations. We operate a clinic the second Saturday of every month at the facility.
Who pays for all this?
Actually, donations in the private sector. It doesn't even come from the taxpayers.
Oh.
So we've been doing this for 12 months through private donations and grants and sponsorships.
And CMPD's Animal Care and Control Organization has been touted as the Southeast most progressive animal welfare organization. How so?
I think many organizations have come on board recently with that. We'd like to say, as a municipal organization, that we were early on one of the ones that embraced the partnerships with the humane societies, mm-hmm. and working together collaboratively, we've been able to find much more success in doing so. Mm. I know Shelley and I have taken this dog and pony show, per se, on the road, and we have relayed the messaging to people within this industry that it truly works when you work together.
And you've adopted a problem resolution philosophy. What does that mean?
And that's what Nia was also saying, with this softer approach to dealing with the public, less judgmental approach. We don't want to be known as the bad guys, those dog catchers mm-hmm. that are out there. What we want to do is go out there, identify that you have a situation that you need some assistance with, whether it's restraint. And that's why Nia is a great supporter of that. If we have people in the zip codes that Nia is making, doing fence builds in, we contact her and we ask for assistance in that. So usually people want to be good owners. They just lack some of the basic resources or awareness in how to become a good pet
owner. Do you occasionally run into people who don't buy into the philosophy either of unchaining their dogs? It's just not, they're not going to do it because they've always done it. And Mama did that, and Daddy did that, and Grandma did that. I mean, are they just not going to change?
They start off that way.
Some of it's cultural, and we understand it. Some of it is financial. Not everybody can afford to have a fence. Some people have rental property, and Nia and I worked together on a council adjustment when we did the tethering law back in 2011, and we know it was going to be a far leap to go from having tethering and no restrictions to having an anti-tethering campaign. But we believe we've had some success back there in 2011, getting a lot of dogs off of those logging chains, short chains. And we've seen the most horrific situations where they've jumped over fences while being tethered and gotten in bad predicaments.
Yeah.
when you're restrained, other stray dogs come into you and you're just virtually helpless because you're bogged down, you're tethered, and another dog comes into your space. So great success in making some progress. We as a community still have a long way to go.
The Humane Society, I'm told, averages about 120 to 150 animals in your shelter or in foster care and available for adoption at any given time. And last year you gave care to more than 2,000 animals. You place about 52 animals a week in what you call their forever homes. Again, how does that compare to other cities of our size? Are we doing a good job, better job?
Well, I think that the city as a whole, and we're just part of that piece of adoption throughout the city. You know, Animal Care and Control has an adoption program also, and I think, you know, with our limitations on the number of animals that we can actually house at one time, yes, I think we're doing a good job with placements. Thing that I think is really important for people to know, though, is that adoption really is only one piece of the solution. There's really so many other things that come into this. It's we want to prevent them from ever ending up in the shelter anyway. So prevention is a huge focus of the Humane Society, and we do that through our spay-neuter programs.
Okay.
And last year we spay-neutered over 12,000 dogs or cats and rabbits to prevent that overpopulation and animals ending up in shelters. So adoption is just a small piece of what we do. When we do that, though, we want to make sure that we make good placements and that we're a resource for those people once the animal gets into their home, so it does end up being a permanent placement.
So they can call on you for help and advice after
yes,
the fact.
Yes, we have a behavior manager that can help with if there's any behavior problems, and we have training classes for adopters, and then they also have access to
And CMPD's Animal Care and Control also has something called Rescue Group Partners, 188 of them, I'm told. How does that differ from the foster program at the Humane Society?
They're actually one of our partners. So the Humane Society of Charlotte actually transition around 1,200 animals into their care each year. That's the same process that we do with the other 501c3 organizations, rescue organizations. Some of them are breed specific. Others are an all breed rescue. So they use their networks. They use their foster volunteers. And they're also able to take at least 1,000 animals from the municipal shelter into their care, provide vetting for those animals, and then use their network for adopters. But Shelley's exactly right. We'll never adopt our way out of euthanasia. It goes far beyond that.
I mentioned in the beginning that puppy mills and breeders evidently have little or no regulation attached to how they operate and no laws governing their operation. Why then is CMPD involved in animal care and control? I mean, if we're not going to control the source, why control the owners?
That's a great question. We unfortunately are an open admission facility because government feels that there is a role that we need to play in facilitating the unwanted population of companion pets. Now, how they come about and why they come into our care through unregulated breathing is
Have your organizations? It's not just like some guy in a backyard, although I'm sure sometimes it is. But sometimes these are big operations, right? So have your organizations pushed for regulations for these breeders and puppy mills?
Yeah, the Humane Society of Charlotte has been very, very active in trying to get this bill passed at a state level. And commercial dog breeding is a real issue in the state of North Carolina. There are no regulations set there. And the
result of that is what?
Well, the animals live in inhumane conditions, primarily unsanitary, lack of veterinary care. There's really no standards on how these animals are kept.
If you buy a pet from one of these puppy mills, are they likely to be ill?
It depends. We do. There's a lot of inbreeding, so there's genetic issues that come up. The Humane Society of Charlotte is actually a responder on puppy mill cases, and we see these dogs firsthand, and they're suffering from matted skin conditions and a lot of dental conditions. The one that we were involved with last week had two dogs with missing eyes.
Is that where there was a TV story and a newspaper story about this? Is that where those dogs came from?
Yes, that was a commercial dog breeding operation. And another thing that people don't think about is that this is really one of the very few businesses in our state that's not regulated at all.
So how do these places work? I mean, obviously there would be no supply if there were no demand for these animals. So why did people choose to buy from breeders or puppy mills, or do they buy direct, or do they then sell these animals to pet stores? How does it work?
Well, I think one of the reasons people buy from them is that they don't know. They don't realize that they're doing it, because the operators of these businesses have gotten very good at advertising their puppies and showing their puppies in a way that a lot of times most people do not know what they're getting. And most pet stores, especially the large chains like PetSmart and Petco, have adopted a practice of not adopting dogs and cats out from their store, specifically because this is what was ending up in their stores. And right now, the primary way that these puppy mills advertise is through the internet, or Craigslist. So people may see that there's a purebred dog available, and then typically, these breeders will either meet them somewhere or have a show place set up where they just see the puppies, and they never see the adult dogs, many, sometimes hundreds of adult dogs that are kept for breeding purposes.
Are there states that regulate these operations?
Yes, there
absolutely.
Are. Absolutely.
Yes.
And where they are regulated, are you opposed to them?
No, we're not opposed to regulation of puppy mills.
And where they are regulated, what are conditions like? And why don't we follow suit? Is it politics?
It is politics. And in fact, our own Senator Bob Russo voted against the Puppy Mill Bill Act in 2010.
Let's see, he wants to run the airport but not dogs and cats.
Right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, we've got one of our own senators who doesn't support regulation of puppy mill bills, and yet we're known in the country as a puppy mill state. So, you know, clearly something needs to be done when you've got our resources, taxpayers' money going to clean up puppy mills. We need to get our senators on board.
Are there enough dogs and cats and other pets in shelters run by the Humane Society and the CMPD to supply the demand to somebody who would like a pet?
Absolutely. The supply has always been there. And I think we're starting to see a national trend where it's not the popular thing to have a pure breed AKC companion pet. I think now the fashion is that people, movie stars and other big figures, they're always saying adopting from rescues and shelters is the more correct thing, politically correct thing to do.
Is the puppy mill suggested legislation dead, or is it still in discussion?
Still in play.
It passed the House last Thursday, and it goes to the Senate now.
Okay, and what's the likelihood of passage for that bill, do you think?
Well, we know the governor's behind it. Okay. We certainly know that. He's a big supporter of it. Mm-hmm. It got bumped last year. I think it's been there. I think there's a high awareness of the bill.
And why is there opposition? What was Bob Ruscio's reasoning?
That's a really good question. I know that there were certain organizations that lobby against the puppy mill bill every year. It's organizations that have nothing to do with puppies. So it's the NRA, it's the North Carolina Pork Council. And they're getting involved with legislation here that I think the majority of our citizens, you know, want.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off, Mia, but I think one thing that's really, really important to say about this is that this is just putting standards in place. This isn't eliminating the practice. I mean, ideally, we would like to see no dogs mass produced in this state. But this is just actually putting regulations in and identifying and defining what a commercial breeder is. I mean, these businesses, there's so much lost revenue for the state. They're not paying taxes. I mean, they're just selling puppies and the profit is under the table and nobody's looking at it. And no other business in this state is allowed to operate like that. So for us, it's just, we cannot understand why this is allowed to go on.
There must be a puppy mill lobby. Hard to believe. I was actually surprised to learn that there were no state standards whatsoever. Nia Warren, who is with us from the Coalition to Unchain Dogs, we've already talked a little bit about what you do and how you make your non-judgmental approach to people to unchain their dogs, and sometimes they don't have the wherewithal to do that. They're renters. They can't bring the dog in the house because the landlord says, no, you can't. They have to go to work. What are they going to do with the dog? And they can't afford to put a fence up. So you help them with
that. That's right. That's right. What we do is we build free fences for those who chain their dogs outside 24 hours a day.
And what about landlords who say, I don't want a fence around that house?
That typically doesn't happen. Usually the landlords are happy to see that there's going to be a barrier put up around the dog. It might be something that the landlord hadn't considered before. And the other thing is that whenever that tenant moves with their dog, we take the fence down and move it with them so that a dog unchained is always unchained. Hmm. They don't have to go back to living that way.
Have you ever run into restrictions, neighborhood restrictions, that say you can't put a fence up?
Well, what we've run into are homeowners associations that say you can't put up anything but, you know, say a wood fence or a split rail fence. And that's, you know, we don't have the funding for that kind of
so
fence.
So what do? Do you ever put in these electronic invisible?
No, we don't do that. We really put up the actual barrier because, you know, part of the issue is the safety issue. Mm-hmm. And if we put up an electronic fence, that still wouldn't prohibit a child from walking into that area where the dog is.
I see. How did it come about? Whose idea was it to build fences? That's a lot of work.
Well,
you did it this weekend and it was hot.
We did. It was really hot. And we did some repairs too. And, you know, we've got some great volunteers. They come out every single weekend. And I think, you know, you just get addicted to it from seeing the dog sitting there on a chain, unable to move and restricted, to running around, getting what we call the zoomies. I mean, literally their back legs are almost in front of their front legs. They are running so hard. So you really get addicted to this. So I think Amanda Arrington, this is her brainchild, the philosophy and the building the fence. But, you know, it is cropping up all over the United States, these fence-building groups.
Nia Warren is Community Outreach Director and founder of the Charlotte Chapter of the Coalition to Unchain Dogs. We're talking about pet welfare, and we will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bragg Financial Advisors, supporting local land trust Catawba Lands Conservancy and its campaign to preserve land, water, and wonder. Details at catawbalands.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Islamic extremists continue their push for control of Iraqi territory. They'll be talking about the growing security crisis in Iraq, America's role, and the high-stakes regional implications there. And then, in the 11 o'clock hour, America's dental health crisis. If you'd like to join our conversation about rescued dogs, cats, and pets, other kinds of pets, now's the time. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is the place to start, along with Twitter and Facebook. And a reminder that they'll be having the CMPD Rescued Dogs, Cats, Kittens, and Puppies for Adoption event going on Saturday, July 5th from 10 to 4 inside South Park Mall. We're coming right back.
2 years ago, we spoke to Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, and here's what she had to say about the financial crisis.
At the end of the day, when we will, you know, comment history, certainly there will be a blame shared amongst many, many players.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Next time on Marketplace, Christine Lagarde of the IMF and where the American economy stands today. It's from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Mike Collins. We're talking about pet welfare in our area today with Shelley Moore, President and CEO of the Humane Society of Charlotte. Mark Balestra is Director of Animal Care and Control with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, one of the more progressive approaches taken anywhere in the country with regard to pets. And Nia Warren is Community Outreach Director and founder of the Charlotte chapter of the Coalition to Unchain Dogs. One more question about that. Your organization, Nia, was responsible for the city tightening its tethering regulations. That law went into effect, I think, in 2011. What has been the result of that? What are the regulations?
Well, the regulations are basically, and Mark can chime in on this too, because he partnered with us and was really helpful in, you know, helping us come up with what would be appropriate. But it was it's 10 feet, basically, is what the tether can be. There has to be a collar around the dog's neck, because what we were seeing a lot was chains, you know, wrapped around the dog's neck. You have to ensure that the chain doesn't exceed 10% of the dog's total weight. And if you have a kennel, it has to provide each dog at least 50 square feet of space. So those are just kind of the highlights of what that ordinance does. And, of course,
Do people check regularly?
We do. We have courtesy complaints that are called in, and people will report dogs are tangled on chains. We saw that problem. We saw strangulation occurring before we mandated swivels placed on both ends of the chains.
Oh, the swivels. That's right.
Why not harnesses? Why collars?
Harnesses work, too. The harnesses are great, but some dogs are really smart and can pull out of them.
Oh, really?
So it depends on your dog. If you have a Houdini, you might have to put the collar on. But that goes back to why I don't think it can be done correctly.
Yeah.
I've seen dogs with collars that are embedded in their necks, and they have to have surgery to remove those collars. And it's not, you know, typically it's not that an owner is doing this maliciously. It's the kind of thing that they just don't see. It's a backyard dog. So they go out and feed the dog. The dog acts happy, and they may not know that this is occurring. And so that's why information is provided.
Can we talk about that just for a second?
Sure.
It seems to me that if you don't know what's going on with the chain embedding in your dog's neck, if you're only going out there to feed it and give it water, which is a nice thing to do. I'm glad they're doing it.
That's right.
Why have the dog?
Well,
you don't love the dog. The dog is not a companion.
Well, I disagree. I don't think that having a dog outside means that you don't love it.
If you don't know what its medical condition is, you don't know that the chain is embedding in its neck, you're not looking. You don't care enough to look.
I think you're right, but I also think that, you know, when you talk about families that live in poverty, sometimes, you know, having a roof over your head that night or trying to get the heat turned back on, those kinds of things become more important than checking on your dog. I'm not saying it's absolutely right. I'm saying that's exactly why there need to be resources there to help.
Larry and Matthews emails, I help out a bit at the Coalition to Unchain Dogs. They get super hardworking volunteers. I've seen 6-year-olds to 80-year-olds, sometimes school participating, and they build a fence so a chain dog can now run around freely. It takes 2 to 3 hours. After the fence building labor, watching the happy dog is thrilling, which is what story that you gave us in our packet here tells us. It's just it's kind of a joyous experience.
It really is. It is. Sometimes it takes a minute for the dog to even realize that they don't have on the chain anymore. But then when they do, they just start running because many dogs haven't done it before. And then, you know, after that, we have aftercare and we provide information. And one of my happiest moments is when we built a fence and I rode through the neighborhood about 2 weeks later and the owner was walking her dog down the street. with a leash that I gave her and a collar, you know, that the Coalition Unchained Dogs provided. And she had never done that before. Hmm. And so it really helps the bond between human and dog. And then they are checking on the dog. You know, people do want to make sure that the dog is okay, and they understand, wow, this isn't just an animal that jumps at me at the end of a chain that I need to feed and that I need to bark in case someone comes into my yard.
Tony in Huntersville says, regarding the child with Down syndrome, which was the first case
that
discovered where the dog was chained up, the child loved the dog and they had no way to bring it inside. The federal, state, and local fair housing acts would have overridden the landlord's rule, he says, about dogs in the home for that child. Because of his disability, the dog was not a pet, but a comfort and emotional support animal.
I think that would be wonderful. And I don't know if he has to be certified as a therapy dog for that to exist. But, you know, I think that, again, highlights the issues that people in underserved communities deal with, mm-hmm. that maybe they don't know all of the rules and they don't know all of the laws. And so when a landlord says you can't have your dog, they say, okay, I need a place to live.
Jenna tweets, would it be good to share that you can register your pet's microchip with CMPD to facilitate reunions?
Absolutely. A great question. We've been promoting registration for microchipping and also just having microchipping clinics. Mm-hmm. It used to be in the early days, the pricing was very outrageous, $60, $70 for microchips. We do clinics, $5 donation. Regardless of where you've obtained your microchip, do register it with your local municipality. We're the ones that have the officers that are out there. They're doing courtesy checks. Sometimes there's just a breach of confinement. Your dog accidentally got out. And what we do is promote the return to the owner from the field. Mm. So the officers have computers in there.
Does it hurt the dog to be microchipped?
No anesthesia whatsoever. Really? When they're inserting the microchips. About the size of a grain of rice.
Okay. Emily from Facebook asks, is Animal Control and the Humane Society investigating zootering? That's an injection of zinc chemical neutering in male dogs, which she understands is less costly and less risky. Is that the case?
Well, I am a little familiar with it. I was the CEO in Asheville, North Carolina, before I came to Charlotte, and we participated in a trial of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some limitations to it. And quite frankly, neutering is probably one of the easiest surgeries for our surgeon. You know, they're trained in a high volume, high quality surgeries. But with the zinc product, the testicles have to be a certain size. The animal has to be a certain age. So there are some limitations to it.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, that's not something that we're doing just because the neuters are so easy to do at our clinic with our surgeons.
We've talked almost exclusively here about dogs. Elizabeth in Mooresville says, please speak to the plight of cats and kittens. Because there got to be a lot of cats out there.
So our number one at-risk animal in the community is the felines. There again, this is where our community needs a lot more education and awareness. Those processes and methods of capture and kill just don't work. We as an organization support the methodology of community cats and feral cat communities. We work with partners that exist out there, the Friends of Feral Felines, Lucky Cats of Lake Norman, that do just that. The answer to resolve that problem, to stop the breeding, and to actually have more managed numbers is to go out there and practice TNR, which is trap, neuter, and return. I think all of our organizations support that practice. Otherwise, you're just going to have that continued cycle of trapping them. Eradication does not work, and they're going to backfill with stray felines that aren't vaccinated, that are not spay or neutered. And
Are there more feral cats than there are dogs on the loose?
Yes, I would say absolutely, yes.
And what problem does that pose for humans or other animals?
The problem is any animal that's not inoculated against rabies. We have rabies within Mecklenburg County.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the number one risk factor. However, we have rabies in raccoons and other animals that you see, wildlife, mm-hmm. that's in our areas as well. It just becomes part of the landscape that we're used to hearing and seeing about squirrels and raccoons, but yet we won't take that same approach to accept community cats as part of our landscape in a more progressive attitude. So that's where the education comes
in. So what should people do if they know that there's a feral cat who comes into their yard every morning or every day at some time? What would you have them do?
I would engage a local organization that's usually participating in that. We have their information from our website. You could actually call Animal Care and Control. We would have a conversation with you. If anyone would be interested in housing a colony that has more of a location, it's more rural, mm-hmm. more dense, less population, that would be a good thing to do. We would support Shelley's organization. We have programs right now. We'll support and pay for the spay-neuter for free, and we'll provide rabies inoculations for free and return them back out there. Mm. And gradually, the populations of companion cats will no longer exist.
Is it just cats and dogs, or are there – you mentioned rabbits a little while ago. Are there other animals that we should be concerned about, either how they're being housed, treated, fed, dealt with, released, et cetera?
Well, I think as, you know, the human species, that we should be concerned about all animals and how they're treated.
But does a particular animal outside of dogs, cats present problems?
Problems.
Not nearly as at risk. And we're dealing with the animals. I think of the three of us. We're dealing with the population of domestic dogs and cats that are at risk from euthanasia, from
ending up in shelters.
How much of the problem do you think that you guys face who have to deal with strays and with animals that have been released by their owners or let go by their owners comes from the fact that owners may buy a dog or a cat for little Johnny or little Susie and they realize a year into it, my gosh, this is expensive. I can't afford this. Or the child loses interest, doesn't take care of the pet even though they promised to, and the parents don't have time. How much of it has to do with that?
Well, I mean, I do think that a large number of animals that, and Mark, I know will have the statistics, that end up at the shelter or owner surrender, but you would be surprised of the reasons why. And a lot of it has to do with changes in their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they've lost a job or they're moving and they can't take it with them. But recently, we've partnered with Animal Care and Control and our own agency in doing safety net programs. So if someone comes to the shelter and says, you know, I have an animal that I can no longer keep, we talk to them, we find out why, and then we try to provide a solution to that person so they can keep that pet.
Huh.
So retention is a really key part of what we're focused on, keeping those animals in the home.
The cost of pet ownership, it seems, would begin with spaying and neutering and the shots they have to get when you buy a dog license, for instance. But I don't think you have to buy a cat license, do you?
Not going there.
but when you buy from a breeder or a puppy mill, has that already been taken care of? Is that part of the price versus when you get a dog or cat from some other place?
Well, I think it typically depends on who you're buying it from. You know, there are responsible breeders out there, and responsible breeders are going to be providing, you know, the appropriate veterinary care for those animals. That normally does not include a spay-neuter unless they feel like they should not breed that animal.
And your two organizations, if I'm heard correctly, do very low-cost spay-neutering and other vaccinations as well. Is that open to anybody, no matter their monetary means?
Yes. So our organization operates two low-cost spay-neuter clinics, and we are altering every animal that gets adopted from our shelter and from Mark's shelter, and it's open to the general public. So we have a program that if you cannot afford our low-cost, and I believe the most expensive surgery is $65, if you cannot afford that, we do have a program where we can help subsidize
that. How do you determine whether they can afford it or not?
We have a conversation with them. We ask them what they can afford. We believe that some people want to contribute to getting mm-hmm. that surgery, but that's really the main reason.
You know, once or twice a year, and I think regularly on Time Warner Cable News, they do a segment from the animal welfare places, and they show pictures of these very cute little dogs and cats. And some animals seem to be adopted very quickly because they are cute. Are there other factors at work here? Why do some animals seem to be instantly adoptable and others languish in these shelters?
Well, I think we've seen, as Mark mentioned earlier, a trend where shelters are ending up with harder-to-adopt pets now. And that's not just here in Charlotte, but across the country. Typically, people want young puppies, kittens that mm-hmm. they can raise on their own. A lot of times, depending on their living situation, with a community that has a large apartment and condo population, smaller dogs are, you know, in high demand. So the shelters do end up with the harder to place larger dogs and cats.
Around the country, there are kill and non-kill facilities. What do we have here?
Well, we as a municipality, we don't have a choice. We're an open admission facility, which means they're, again, trying to not be judgmental. We have to take in every animal that comes in from Mecklenburg County that's presented to us. It's finding more positive outcomes, which becomes the challenges.
How many don't reach a positive outcome?
Our strategy this year is to hit a target of live release rates of 65%. Wow. But when we started that program, we were only hitting a 48% live release rate.
So it's getting better.
It's getting much better.
And as you said at the beginning of the program, although you'll probably reach 13,000 dogs and cats in that you have had intake with over the course of a year, that number is actually down even as the population of both people and pets has grown. So something good is going on out there. So maybe it's education, maybe it's the spay and neuter program. What should potential pet owners and pet owners today know about the responsibilities of pet ownership? What are the key factors? Very quickly.
Well, very quickly is spay-neuter. That's the number one thing. Spay-neuter your pet regardless where you get that animal. We've made it where it's affordable. And it's easy to get to, and there's no reason not to. There's no sense of breeding your animal if you really don't have a particular plan in mind.
And if people simply find that they cannot afford to keep a pet or they desperately need a fence because they like the idea of not chaining their dogs, what do they do?
They can go on our website. It's unchaineddogs.org and go to the Charlotte chapter and send us an email.
And if they can't keep their dog?
Well, definitely reach out to us. We have lots of programs that we can help them if there's a one particular issue that's preventing them from keeping them. But they can visit our website at humanecharlotte.org.
We'll put those websites up on ours. Mark Balestras, Director of Animal Care and Control for the CMPD. Nia Warren, Community Outreach Director and Founder of Charlotte Chapter of Coalition to Unchain Dogs. And Shelley Moore, President and CEO of the Humane Society of Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.